mis amigos lograron.
My friends were able to escape, and they caught me, and they began to hit me. They were punishing me. They were cutting my hands.
Me estaban cortando las manos.
This is a story of escape.
In the town where I live, there is a lot of crime, and there is a gang there that is, like, bad. And they're looking for people in order to grow in size and, as they say, expand their territory.
18-year-old Melvin grew up in a mountain town in Guatemala where violent gangs were a daily reality, and one he was always aware of. Then one day, a year ago, in the fall of 2017, Melvin found himself face-to-face with a local gang's brutality.
They began talking with me, and they said, "Hey, man, you know, we need more people in our gang. Do you want to join our gang? Would you like that?" And I said, "No." I said, "No, I did not want to. I wasn't going to leave my studies for things that weren't good." Then, after some time, they got tired, and I think on the 12th or 14th of September, they beat me. Between all of them, they beat me because I didn't want to tell them yes. They thought I would fight back, but then they all began piling on and began beating me. I think I bled from here, with punches all over here.
The gang tortured Melvin, using knives to slice slowly and painfully into his arms. With the support of his parents, he fled to the U.S. seeking safety. Alone, Melvin set out on the dangerous journey to the border on the infamous cargo train known as the Beast. But once he made it to Arizona, his battles had only just begun. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, the story of unaccompanied minors fleeing to the United States and what happens once they arrive. We've been talking a lot in this country about the children separated at the border under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy, as we should be, and we will continue those conversations. But those children represent a small segment of the minors crossing the border to come to the United States. Young people like Melvin come to the U.S. by the thousands each month on their own, fleeing horrific situations in their home countries and finding a new set of challenges when they arrive here in search of asylum. In the not-too-distant past, a young man like Melvin would have had a narrow shot at asylum given the violence he was looking to escape and the physical evidence on his body of the cruelty he faced in Guatemala. But in the last few years under the Trump administration, the asylum process has gotten more complicated. With us now is Beth Fertig, a senior reporter covering immigration, courts, and legal affairs at WNYC. Beth, it's great to have you with us.
Thanks so much.
So let's start off, because this is such a complicated story, I think, for a lot of Americans. When we say unaccompanied minors in the United States, what do we mean?
Unaccompanied minors, or as they're known by the government, unaccompanied alien children, are kids who cross the border without a parent. More than half of them are over the age of 15. They're mostly from the triangle countries of Central America, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, places that are very dangerous and also very poor. And they will come by themselves, or maybe with friends or other relatives who are not their parents, come to the U.S. border. And sometimes they sneak in, but very often they go to a border agent and say, I'm seeking asylum. I want to stay here. And then after they are sent to stay with a sponsor, another relative who's staying in the U.S., they will go to immigration court and have their case heard by a judge.
Prior to the Trump administration, tell us a little bit about what that process was like.
So in the past, it was never easy to win asylum from the immigration lawyers I've spoken to. But this past spring, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who controls the immigration courts, they're an arm of the U.S. Justice Department, he ruled on a case about a woman fleeing domestic abuse in Central America. And he said that people who are fleeing gang violence and domestic abuse, they're fleeing criminals who are private criminal actors. They're not part of the government. It's not like the government was beating the woman or the government was committing violence on these teens who are trying to be recruited into gangs. So he said those are private criminal actors, and it makes it much tougher. His orders to the immigration judges were, it's very tough right now to grant asylum. In the past, however, the judges would have some discretion. They could say, well, you know, I think in this particular case, I'm going to side with the kid's lawyer. And what's happening now is there is no guaranteed right to a lawyer in immigration court for anybody. But it's especially difficult for children because they're children. They don't know the law. They don't have an adult coming with them. And so there's been an effort over the years to provide lawyers for the children. But in the past year, it's the number of kids who are represented goes down. If you don't have a lawyer, you're virtually never going to get your case heard. Last year, fiscal year 2017, only about 40% of the kids got lawyers. And what's happened is the lawyers are saying that they are so busy now with Trump's immigration policies, their cases are taking longer, it's harder to get new clients. And Tanzino, there's also a weird quirk in the New York City Immigration Court where they used to have a room for the lawyers to meet with the kids on certain days when the kids would come to court and there'd be three judges assigned to hear their cases. And now that room was taken away because they needed to turn it into another courtroom. So the kids come to court, and this is how I met Melvin. They come to court by themselves. There's nobody to meet them and say, here's how to get a lawyer. There's just some lawyers passing out flyers in the hallway. And Melvin is by himself, completely afraid, thinking he's going to get deported that day, when that's not actually what's going to happen. He's just appearing, and the judge is asking, do you have a lawyer? He didn't have a lawyer. He was told, okay, you have three more months, come back. Hopefully you'll have a lawyer then. And he leaves terrified, thinking, what am I going to do? I have to find a lawyer.
So if a minor does not have, say, a sponsor or a family that's waiting to take them in, they can't find a lawyer, what happens?
It's very difficult. Melvin was lucky because he came in the beginning of the year. He was released to an uncle who lives in Bushwick. But if he had come later this year, the Trump administration made it harder for the sponsor, the relative, to take the child by adding a stricter background check with fingerprinting that would also inform immigration of that sponsor's status. So Melvin's uncle is undocumented. A lot of the kids who are coming now are staying longer and longer in the shelters where they're placed when they first cross the border, like Melvin. He only stayed for about a month in Arizona. Then he was placed with his uncle. But these days, the kids are staying several months. The shelters are backlogged now with kids, and that's why they're moving some of the kids to a tent city in Texas, where they don't have the same rights to an education every day that they would in a normal shelter that's contracted with the federal government and has to meet certain standards. They can stay in this tent city in kind of harsher conditions. They're trying to pick, I've heard, the kids who are ready to be placed with sponsors very soon, so they're not little ones who are going to be hanging out for a long time, but it's still a difficult situation, and it's because of this bottleneck right now that the background checks have made it harder to place the children.
Given that bottleneck and given these delays, are there concerns about what could happen to these kids when they're in this limbo? Are they more susceptible to running away? Are they more susceptible to mental health issues because they're
Absolutely.
Sort of caught in this limbo? Like, what happens when this is now extended, this time period where they're staying in this limbo is extended to these kids?
Well, first, these kids are in trauma if they are fleeing violence. And even if they're not, it's a pretty dramatic journey to come to the U.S. In Melvin's case, he rode the Beast, which is this series of cargo trains that kids and other migrants jump on top of and ride for days. It's very, very dangerous. And he was actually robbed at the end of it before he got to the border. Some bandits took money from him. But it's a tough experience getting to the U.S. Then you're staying in this kind of limbo for a while without somebody who loves you. It's an agonizing wait. And the longer you drag it out, child experts in trauma and child psychology say it just makes it much, much more difficult for these kids to become more resilient when they come out. They don't feel the love and support of somebody. They've been living in limbo. They don't know their future. These are young minds that are still developing. Many of the kids, remember, are younger than teenagers. So it's not a situation that you want to prolong. On the other hand, the government says we're doing these background checks because sometimes the kids get placed with traffickers. That has happened. There have been cases where the government doesn't really do a good job of checking who the kids went to in the past, and they wound up going to people who could take advantage of them and exploit them. So you do want to make sure that they're going to someplace safe, but to delay it this long is what immigration advocates are saying is very dangerous for the children.
And can you give me an update on where Melvin is today?
Yeah. First of all, he's very typical. So he's in some ways, and I don't want to be glib about this, he is just like thousands of other kids, okay? But he's not. He's his own person with his own story of being threatened, of being cut on the arm by people who tried to recruit him to join a gang to sell drugs and to kill people. And that was very, very scary for him. And his family said, you have to leave, because they prey on teenage boys. And if he had known more about the process, for example, he could have photographed his wounds when he was in Guatemala. He could have gone to a doctor, although he said there was no hospital in his town. He could have maybe gotten some affidavits or something from people to say what had happened. But he just came. He didn't know what to do. And so now his story is suspect. It's just a story. He still has the scars. He's going to have to, now that he has a lawyer, he's going to meet with a trauma expert, a clinical social worker, to kind of piece together his story, because it's a little bit fragmented. You know, it's hard. He's very reserved. And it's tough. It's going to be a few years probably before his case goes to court. And ironically, because the courts are so backlogged, it could hurt Melvin's case that it's taking so long, but it could also help him if there's another president at the end of this with different immigration policies. So we don't know what's going to happen. But in the meantime, he's working at a pizzeria to pay for his lawyer. He's not supposed to work until he gets working papers, which you do after you file for asylum. But he has to pay for his rent. He has to pay for his lawyer. And this kid works 6 days a week. And he's a very industrious kid. He'd like to learn English. He doesn't have the time to take classes. He could conceivably enroll in high school, but he doesn't have the time because he wants to pay and he wants to do the right thing and go to court.
Beth Fertig is a senior reporter at WNYC. Beth, thanks so much for helping us with this story.
Thank you for having me.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.